So it is July 30th of 2015, and I'm here with Ray Collins in Madras, and I would like to ask him about the traditional beliefs, medicine man, and the church relations in Nikola, Alaska. So can I ask you some questions?
Yes.
So the other day we are talking about the historical salmon runs and populations, and do you know anything about like what was going on in the historical salmon runs around Nikolai?
On salmon, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the first salmon was shared with the community. I don't know if there was a formal ceremony there, but they recognized the first one, and I think often that was it was important traditionally how they treated that first salmon that came up. In one way was by sharing it around the community. You didn't keep it for personal use. And that was in the past. I don't know if that continues now, but that's the only one I know with that. Well, and then there was the traditional stories about the girl that turned into a fish and went back and came back and reported and so on, and that people had, need to be prepared for the season, so they didn't take it casually, like they used clean poles to hang the fish on and things like that, that relate to that story and so on. But that was just fish and all the game had to be retreated respectfully. Also, it came up in potlatches later when we were sharing meat. They didn't put meat and fish on the same plate. If they were passing around and you ate the fish, that was separate and so on, because one's from the land and one's from the sea, and they kept those separate. And that was out of respect. I mean, now we're feeding off what comes from the sea or now from the land, and so they didn't mix them on a plate. But other than that, I can't think of anything else on fish. The general prohibition of not wasting, not catching fish for something. But they, so they were either used for personal consumption or for dog food. And that's one of the reasons that I think the decline of the fish wheels is when they didn't have to put up dog food again, they would be catching fish that they could not use for eating. So they shifted to a net where they had more choice of when they put it and where they put it. So,
So do you know more about the traditional stories about animals? Like you're talking about the salmon, but like other animals.
yeah. Well, I guess my first exposure to that was when, on my first hunt when I went out with a man and his two sons from Nikolai, and actually an elder, Gleeman Esai. We were going up the North Fork and so on, and we hadn't seen any moose. And we stopped at a lake where somebody had made an earlier kill, and we killed a black bear there. There was a black bear on the remains of some of the gut pile and so on that had been left in the lake. And the young man shot that. That was his first black bear. And they apologized. I wasn't fluent in the language, and that basically they apologized and thanked the bear for that they had killed him, you know, and so on, and that they would eat him and so on. And then the head was taken off, and a little spruce tree about 6 feet tall was bent over, and the head was put on that and left, so it wasn't just laying on the ground because they weren't going to use the head. And then nobody wanted the skin, so I took it and used it for ground cover, and later on I dried it and used it in my sled. But they asked me afterwards whether I'd slept good that night, because again, some of the power of the bear, I guess, is thought to reside in that. And I said no, I had no problem, I slept fine. And the young man, when they were skinning it too, then they took the hindquarters off except for the one tendon, and they had him use his forefinger in there and tear that kingdom out, that tendon loose, I mean, on to sever the hind quarter there. And that was kind of a test of strength, and that would mean that he would be strong later if he could do that. So he was old enough to do that successfully. So there were things like that that were built in with how the animals were treated. Also, they they blinded the bear's skull before they put it up there because they didn't want the bear spiritually to be watching them butcher the rest of his carcass there. So that, again, was out of respect for the bear. They just poked both eyes and then put the head up there. There's quite a bit around the bear because it's a powerful predator like people, so that anytime you found a den in the wintertime, you didn't talk about that around women, because if you said anything about it, the bear wouldn't be there when you went back. So that I think probably in retrospect, it had to do with the fact that women are givers of life and the predator's a taker of life and the hunters are takers of life, and they're separating the two. So they didn't talk about them, didn't want the women talking about them. And that women generally didn't eat the bear meat. Only men ate the bear meat when it was brought in and used. And they were also careful on all the animals about if they brought in a sled load, any meat or blood that dripped in the snow, they would, even to the point of going out and shoveling that up and taking it back to the woods or somewhere so people wouldn't walk on it. But that was true of game in general, of caring for. And I suppose I observed these things, but I didn't ask a lot of direct questions because you were supposed to just pay attention and learn that way. But I think probably behind it long term is the fact, again, is that the blood is in the life. When the blood's gone, the gun that's gone, and so on. So it's a respect for the life of that animal that you didn't just leave it on the ground there. And normally they would be bled out in the woods somewhere. And but if you come back and then the blood is dripping in the village, you didn't want people walking on it. They removed. So there was care that some of the elders took on things like that. And again, I don't know if that's continued or not, although in general, I think there's still a lot of respect built in about the animals that feed you. Well, that's what comes to mind now. In terms of old stories, there's a lot of stories about hunting bears and what they did in hunting bears and so on, but that was more how they killed them and, you know, killing them in the den. Originally with spear, and even facing grizzly and killing it with a spear, but only not everybody tried that. You had to be pretty skilled in order to do that. Mm-hmm.
So, do you know any story about dogs? Like old timer stories.
Right. Right. Trying to think about. I can't think of anything especially about that, but aged dogs or dogs that, well, let's say, are crippled or something like that, usually the musher didn't kill them themselves. He'd ask somebody else to take them out and kill them, dispatch them. So once the dog has served you, is that way, I guess, out of respect or reluctance. People didn't want to kill them themselves, so they'd ask somebody to do that for them out there. And of course, there was a lot of paying attention to dogs, listening to dogs. Like the teams were tied up around the perimeter of the village out there, almost encircling the village with the houses on the edge and so on. Few of them were inside, but more of them were kind of on the fringe, and they would listen to those dogs, and the dogs were a kind of a communication system. If there was an animal prowling around, either a moose or a bear or something coming around, then the dogs would usually signal that, were an alarm system. And also their hearing was more, and when we had the regular mail plane that only come a couple times a week, that was an important plane, and everybody tried to meet it because the mail would be delivered right at the plane and they'd sort the sack right there. There wasn't a postmaster in the village. So the dogs would hear that plane before, and they had a special howl, and so they would know a plane was coming. Although people also were alerted with the radios going on about plane coming, you know, somebody would pass the message around. But the dogs themselves gave a warning in that way. That's all that comes to mind right now. Everybody had a dog team, of course, when we first went up there in 63. And they were used for hauling their wood and their water and running the trap lines and so on. And if you didn't have a dog, you would borrow dogs, like sometimes, and sometimes fewer dogs. Like I actually trapped with Philip Esai, and at times I had three dogs to begin with, and he had about four, so we put our team together because it was easier that way when we were going out on the trap line and so on to have the teams together, yeah, especially if we're hauling back meat or something. And
do you remember any traditional Fuzosh stories about giant animals? Or any like predatory animals?
No, but there was the Woodman story, and there were little people that lived out at the mountains, and they were believed to be able to take a regular animal form. Like when they were going out the hills to hunt, there was one cave by Farewell. If you happen to go by that way, they'd often leave dry fish there and say, well, this is what we brought you from down below, you know, help us in hunting while we're at the hills and so on. And they thought that those little people, they could cause mischief too, like a knife is missing already, well, maybe it was stolen by them. And then sometimes they would indwell an animal, because I know in one case we were on a sheep hunt there, and they shot several times at one sheep and couldn't hit it when it was within range and so on, and that sheep left. And they said, well, maybe that was a little person in that sheep, that's why we couldn't kill it and so on, because it had special ability to, I guess, to avoid people. And the woodsman story had to do with, again, they would be predatory or could cause come in and steal things or break into caches and so on. I know there was one story. The summer we came, Chief Devion died, and everybody was already down. It was in May, and everybody was down in fish camp, so they went back to the funeral, but they'd left one woman behind to take care of the dogs, feed them while they were gone on there. And all of a sudden, a bearded man came walking up the bank from the river, and she didn't know where from. And so the story was, and asked about matches, and she gave him some matches, and then he disappeared again, went off. Well, it turned out later, I heard the story, there was an anthropologist from Fairbanks, actually, that was floating the river in a raft, but she hadn't gone to the river. She never saw that. So this guy appeared and asked for something and left. And at first, she was thinking, well, that was a must have been a woodsman. That was a story that was going around. And it wasn't until later that I heard from Fairbanks that somebody had actually stopped there on a floating down the river. So that explains some unnatural events that way. But there is a fairly strong belief that the woodsman did exhibit or did live. And one source of that might have been, if somebody caused a lot of problems, they could banish them. Well, if a person was banished from the village, the only way they could live is by preying on either those people or somebody else in fish camp and so on. And sometimes like that, somebody that had been out on his own and so on. I remember one story was telling me by Pete Gregory about if they captured somebody like that, they actually put him in a hole in the ground for a while, and they kind of had to bring him back from his wild state to domestic state again and feed him there. So there were people that, besides the woodsmen, I guess, that actually went wild, and that could have been, the source of that could have been people that were banished from another community or something for misbehaving, you know, too much trouble they were causing. But Yeah, and in general, there was that strong belief in the woodsmen and the little people, the only two that I'd heard about. I didn't hear about any. Oh, sometimes there was a big fish too in some lakes. They talk about a pike, but a huge pike that could upset canoes and so on. So some lakes were avoided sometimes for not canoeing in. Usually it was a larger lake system and so on, and because there might have been a big fish in that, so that there were stories about the oversized fish in some lakes.
As for the little people, somebody told me that they killed a sheep and it turned into a little people, somebody told me. So that was interesting to hear that similar
Oh,
story.
okay.
Have you heard about metamorphosis,
No, but
animals
this,
turning to
yeah, that's
little
the, in the
people?
story I was telling you about, the one sheep that they weren't able to kill, they were thinking it was a little person. So it was a person that had transformed himself into a sheep.
So yeah, I guess it's
Yeah,
the same idea.
same idea there, only this one they did kill, but then it turned into a little person, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, very interesting. So, do you know anything about the traditional beliefs about the Northern Lights or stars?
Boy, I don't recall any specific stories about that. I'm sure there were some. I know they would view the Northern Lights. I was thinking, I don't know the context, but I heard that some people, they could whistle to make the lights dance or something like that, or move. They responded to music in some ways, but I don't know where I heard that, whether it was at Nikolai or in the general Athabascan cultural context. I don't remember a specific time when somebody at Nikolai told me about that. They were very keen on observing changes in the weather. And that was just kind of reading the signs. But like, if the grass grew real tall in the summertime, that meant there was going to be deep snow that winter, because the snow had to cover the grass. So they would use that as a measurement of whether there was going to be a deep snow winter or not, of how the grass stood. And of course, if you were getting in a wet cycle, then you would be getting rain and tall grass and then snow following it and so on, so that there were signs they looked for in the weather that way. They used what was called a bull roarer, which is a stick on the end of a string that they whirl around and makes a whirling noise. That was used to call, they thought could call the wind. They talked about, I'd heard stories about that. Let's see, what are. Well, that's all that comes to mind right now. Maybe I'll think of something after.
Do you know any story about the moon or traditional stories about the moons, about the moon?
No. But there was the use of the stars for navigation. I know they had names for some of the stars, and I was never identified. They. And I think there's names for some of the constellations, but I never got into that specifically with them. But I just know that they could go out and tell the time at night somewhat by the movement of the stars. So they were observing that and using it for guidance. It's like the North Star, I guess, and the Little Dipper is supposed to point to. But I never heard of specific. They didn't call it the Little Dipper, but it was like that of using the stars for getting directions or keeping clock of the time at night. And of course, the moons, the month names were moons. So they used those, they had a calendar built around the moons. And those usually had to do with the movement of animals. Like there was the, well, January was the midwinter when time was kind of equalized between night and day and so on in the wintertime. And then Eagle Month was early, I think in late February or March, and then birds coming back in March. I think, yeah, Yadi Na'a, I think, was February. But it was associated with the moon, the changes in the moon. And then the birds coming back, the migration of birds, and then the salmon in the summertime, fish, and late September, October, that moon indicated bull moose month. That's when the bulls were active in the rut and so on. So the moons were used, as I said, that was a way of clocking the calendar, where they were at was by the moon, following the full moons.
Do you know any kind of talisman or good luck charm for boys and girls?
Yeah, the main thing for young people, they were encouraged to listen. And someone who wouldn't listen was spoken of as someone who probably wouldn't live long, because their instruction came out of the stories. So if you knew the stories that people told about survival or whatever and so on, or even in the treatment of animals, then you would know how to behave properly, and you would know what to do in various situations to avert cold or all the other things. But if you didn't pay attention to those stories, it was like closing the book or not opening the book to read, and not getting the instruction you needed. And that's why there would be storytelling at night by elders, and they would often tell stories until people went to sleep. There were no lights early on in the evening time, but somebody would start telling stories, and people had to respond so that they were listening. Somebody had to be responding. As soon as there were no responses, then the stories would stop, meaning nobody's listening anymore. They're sleeping or whatever. Because I know when I first went to record in the evening on one, the fellow was giving me stories. It was earlier in the evening, but still, I didn't know the responses, so I had to ask one of my friends to respond, because I didn't know how to just so at the proper place in the story, knowing that they were listening to that. And so there was that response. And also then, stories were very specific. If you ask a question about something, they would think about it, and you might get a story later if you didn't pay attention. And I gave the example of Pete using the story about rifles that had gone missing from the cache at Venezuela when we were talking about old-time rifle, and I'd ask him, he didn't know what had happened to them, but then he came back later with a story about getting extra work or compensation by a steamboat captain. And what he was implying was that perhaps he took those, and that's why he was generous with him that spring and work and so on. But he didn't want to accuse him because he didn't know, and the fellow didn't fess up to it. So they're pretty careful about not making observations. In fact, they say you have to be careful what you say, because your words may come back on you. That was one of the old-time sayings, was that be careful about your speech. And I know some people have the reputation of being storytellers, and I know in one case there where the river had cut through above Nikolai, and somebody reported it, and they asked me, because I knew I'd been up there. They were just verifying that what he had reported was accurate, because it was somebody that was kind of wasn't, whatever I want to say, was a storyteller, in other words, in the wrong sense of the word, somebody that couldn't always be relied on as being completely accurate. So you had to be careful again on how you gave out information, that it was accurate, or you could get a reputation. And in general, I know this is where Caucasians often get into trouble, because we talk about the future, about like what we're going to do next summer or somewhere, and we don't do all of that. And there we don't. That means we're unreliable. They won't. If they're pressed on something, they'll say maybe, but they don't say definitely they're going to do, because, and that's true, the future is not in our hands. We don't know for sure. So they're very careful in committing themselves to what's going to happen in the future there. And at the most, if you try to press them, there'd be a maybe. It's because it's kind of, you take one day at a time and do what's appropriate for that day. You can't speculate on what's going to happen tomorrow. Except, you know, signs looks like we might get this kind of weather because of the signs. And sometimes after the case, too. I know with, they watch the behavior of animals, like when they're in fish camp in the summer over at Salmon River, they used to put in the weir. If a grizzly is really hanging around closely around their camp and so on, or acting strangely, that may be indication that something is going to happen to one of those people there. And they make the connection afterwards. Oh, somebody gets sick or something like that after. And said, oh, that's why the bear was acting that way, because there was a feeling that animals had more information than you did about what was going to happen in the future. And their behavior could signal that. And I know it was interesting. There was a funeral here the other day of a young woman. And an eagle came and flew over twice. One came and then another one appeared up while we were doing the interment out there. And somebody said to me, oh, that must have been, that was a good sign. It was like they were being acknowledged by the eagle that they were burying this person and so on. And then after drownings and other accidents, they might be looking back for, was there any indication or sign of that and what happened? I know another time, what was it? Oh, that was weather. There was a biologist from here and somebody else that was out flying, counting game or something, and crashed over by Farewell. And they didn't recover the bodies for a while. And it was too cold or something like that. And they had real cold weather and so on. And so they were saying that until those bodies were moved, that's why we had the bad weather and so on. It was associated. Mm. And another one that was interesting was that when people would run trap lines out to the hills, they'd be gone for about a week, but people didn't know for sure when they'd come back. But I remember one, I can't remember whether it was one of the women or one of the men, older men, who was related to the ones out there, said, oh, they must have left the hills today because the hills are sad. They had clouded up out there at the hills. So the hills are responding to, or the weather is responding to the presence of people there, that they're hunting and doing what they should be doing and so on. And when they leave, the there was sadness being felt by their departure by the clouds, or that's why the clouds came in and so on. So often there's, they're looking for signs in nature when there's a death, or when something happens one way or another there, that, oh, that's why they're connected. Part of that whole idea that the environment is aware. I mean, even trees are aware, and plants and animals and all of those things are sentient, I guess it'd be the term you use. They're conscious and they're aware, and they give you information and signs about what's going on that you may not know, that it's all connected. Whereas when we go out, we see an animal, we think the animal's alive, but we don't necessarily think about the trees being responsive to our presence there. But they felt that everything is aware.
Yeah, you were talking about the bear just a few minutes ago. And speaking of bear, I heard some people used to carry a bear's tongue cartridge.
Oh, uh-huh. And
do you know the idea behind it?
That, again, was strength, since that's a strong animal and so on. I think maybe on that first bear, they may have taken that cartridge out and gave it to that young boy. So there were a number of things, like ptarmigan feet were often attached to a baby, because ptarmigan are good at walking around on top of the snow. So that was, and if the child asked about that, going up, oh, that's so you'll be good on snowshoes. So they're thinking that those will affect certain characteristics in there. And it probably actually has that effect. because the child is aware of it and thinking about it, you know, whether he's going to be strong or whatever, you know. So it does influence their behavior, just the fact that it's there when they become conscious of it's there and why it's there. So there were a number of those. I don't have a list of all of them, but that was the one. But something like the grizzly, you had had to be careful on something like that too, because it had to do with strength, but also it might turn out to be mean because they were thought to be meaner. So maybe that's an individual that would pick up that characteristic rather than just the strength.
Okay, now I'd like to ask you about medicine men and medicine women in Nikolai.
Yeah.
And do you know like any medicine persons in Nikolai when you get there?
Yeah, the Gleeman Isai was felt by many to be a medicine man. And he even told me stories about and so on. He was, well, they had animal helpers and so on. I know in one time he told me about he was in Anchorage there and a porcupine had come into somebody's tent and they killed that porcupine and so on. And he said later, he said, oh, you shouldn't have killed that porcupine. That was my helper or something like that. And he said, they believed me too. And he was kind of laughing about it. So I don't know whether he was using that to enhance his power or whether, you know, there was some association between him and a porcupine, but he mentioned that. But the other thing was there was somebody that had an open sore. One of the men had an open sore on his leg and it wasn't healing up, and he'd been treated on with salves and everything else by the medical profession that had come through, and it couldn't heal up. And finally that winter, this had prevailed through the summer from started, I think, in the spring or something like that. And the medicine man put something on it, his own salve or something on there, and it cleared up. And also then another case was that same man, his sister was married to another elder in the village, and he did a lot of drinking, made home brew and so on, and they had destroyed one of his jugs of homebrew because he was doing too much drinking, this man, and so he threatened him and so on. And again, that man developed a stiff neck and he couldn't turn his head, and again they could find no physical reason for it when he was examined by the doctors and so on. And finally that fall again, this had persisted for several months, and he got to where it was so stiff he could hardly turn his head. And finally said somebody else said come back and said, well, I guess Miskadevan's going to get better now. He gave a jug of whiskey back to that man. They used their power that way, or had warned that person, and who knows, you know, what actually caused the illness, whether it was the action of him or whether it was, again, psychosomatic, that he was expecting something. And when he gets this condition, your own psyche comes into play on something like that too as well. But the source of it was this confrontation with the medicine man. So in one case it was healing, in another case it was causing harm to the individual. And so they were careful about how they treated that individual.
Speaking of animal helpers, somebody told me one elder has special relationship with an eagle.
Uh-huh.
And do you know like any example of animal helpers? And
yeah, trying to think. Well, there was mention of that one, the porcupine that he brought up, but I don't know if he didn't specifically say that was an animal helper or something, but he was indicating that he knew about that event and there was something. Just trying to think. I think all of the medicine men were believed to have some special relationship with at least one animal. But I can't think of the specific connections with animals. Uh, But there was that feeling that that was there. There was a power helper and so on, either that helped reveal information to them or would help them in hunting or something like that. In general, again, it had to do with signaling. This wasn't a, well, it was kind of an animal helper in a way that when they call Jizra Moya, which is a shrike, and it looks like Jizra is a camp robber, or Jizra Moya is, it's like a camp robber. It looks quite a bit like a camp robber in terms of its coloring and so on, but it kills little bears. It's a hunter too. And so when we were out hunting on one of their moose hunts there and so on, they spotted a shrike and they were paying attention to it, and it was singing. And so that meant that we were probably going to have luck in hunting that day. If it was completely silent, then it probably meant we wouldn't see any game either. So it was able to convey information. That was just general information. That wasn't a spiritual helper, but the idea that it could give you messages. Trying to think of others. Well, somewhere I had a list of those amulets that they would put on the kids, and I could only think of the two, the ptarmigan foot and then something to do with a grizzly. Or you mentioned that cartilage out of the tongue of the grizzly. But there were more than that that they could put on the child. Yeah, I didn't answer the question again was about special spiritual helpers. What was the last question you'd ask there?
Spiritual helpers.
I can't.
That's kind of difficult to.
Yeah, you'd have to go into the individual stories with, and in general, after Christianity came in, they didn't speak a lot about medicine men. They still believed they were there and they had a certain amount of power and so on, but there wasn't a lot of talking about that, especially with non-Athabascans. They might share them in the family or something, or they would avoid certain people. But people different. I do remember that one of my trapping partners, it was his dad who was a shaman, and he said that he prayed he wouldn't get that. He felt it was a special power that came upon you sometimes and so on, and said he didn't want it, and prayed, he said he prayed that he wouldn't get that because it had run in his family, I guess. So there was attempts to avoid that, but also the feeling that it wasn't entirely your choice, that it could come upon you at some point in your life.
I've seen Philip Isai picking up eagle feathers on the way, like when he's like hiking or something, and like put it on his hat.
Oh,
have you seen like someone doing something like that?
No, but again, the eagle would be a powerful bird, and I could see them saving something like that. Yeah. Because again, the eagle's eyesight and their hunting ability and so on. So it could be related to that, or just interest in the feather too.
But, yeah, maybe.
But yeah, but I haven't. I know there were. Well, let's see. There wasn't a lot of feathers used in decoration that I knew of. There were more of the porcupine quills were the main decorations, and then they traded for dentalian shells, which was the most valuable. And those came clear from Queen Charlotte Islands down in southeast and were traded through and were throughout the interior in most of the chief's necklaces and so on. And then I think the Russians may have brought some in for direct trade that they got in southeast too later. But they were passed from the Tlingit people in southeast, traded with the interior Athabascans in on the Yukon, upper Yukon there, and then those things got traded throughout Alaska and so on, but that was one of the sources of that. and there were certain trade relations that developed between the interior and southeast. For instance, one was moose hide, because down there they only had deer, and the moose hide is much stronger for better protection and warmer robes and things like that. And then, of course, the furs, especially after the fur trade, they could trade for furs. And what they had all around Alaska, the interior meat, especially in the wintertime, is pretty dry. And so there wasn't a source of fat or that. So the Tlingit people put up Ulican oil and traded with the interior. In fact, they referred to the trails, some of those early trails from southeast to the Yukon in there, as oil trails. And the coastal Eskimos put up seal oil and so on in pokes and traded with the interior for wolverine fur was prized for parka trim because it supposedly doesn't hold the frost as well. So it's a good fringe for the, but they didn't have wolverine out on the coast. That was an interior animal. So they would trade for those. Copper, of course, from the Copper River area was traded with the Tlingits in southeast, prized that, and other people used it for weapons before they got a source of iron. I know I don't know the specifics on trading here, because after the Russians came in, the source of outside goods was often through the Russians, but also the people from the Kenai Peninsula used to come over here in the spring while the crust was still on and trade for the interior, because when Zagoskin came up river in 1843 to here, he met the people at Veniseli, and they said they didn't have a lot of beaver skins to trade that spring because they'd already traded with the Kenai people, who brought Russian goods over through the mountains on the trail and traded with them. And the year before, they had received at Kamulkoski Redoubt there, they had taken in something like 2,000 more skins than they did in this particular year. So they were getting a large amount of fur out of this upriver headwaters, but it decreased that year because of the trade with the Kenai. And then, of course, even in this archaeological find here, that in McGrath, of the three bodies there that are identified at least 1,200 years old, I guess, there was no trade goods in there because that dates back way before the Russian showed up here, but there were obsidian in there that came from Batsalnitas up on the Koyukuk. So it shows that there was trade for things like obsidian between clear up on the Koyukuk down here. And somehow the people from here had traded something for that, you know, in terms of fur in order to get that. But in general, headwaters country like this was a hungrier country. There are stories of periodic starvation up here because it depended on the fluctuation in game or fish that summer and so on, up and down, and the populations weren't as great as or as secure as they were down like at the mouth of some of the rivers or some of the other places there. So often they had to keep moving around and use a large area. And they made ties through marriage with surrounding areas too. Even though they spoke other languages, they had ties with the surrounding language groups, and often had to, you would go and stay with that family as compensation for the bride, because they had raised that daughter. And so you'd hunt and trap for them for a while. And then after a year or so, you could go back home or you could stay there with your in-laws. So that was very practical too, because it gave them knowledge of a broader hunting area. They'd grown up in one hunting area, and then through the marriage ties, they spent time in another area, and they might have to go to that area in times of scarcity or something. So in general, you had to become very knowledgeable about a broad area, even outside your immediate vicinity. And trade was often the ties or the links.
Yeah, some people told me that people would go back to the old days, like no store food, uh-huh. like no gasoline and stuff. And
yeah.
Have you heard similar stories?
Yeah. There was talk even in the church. I know spring held on clear into June. The ice hadn't gone out of some of the lakes and so on. And they talked about a time when winter wouldn't stop. It would go year round. And yeah, there was a feeling that there would be a time of scarcity in the future, just as they'd experienced in the past, too. There were times of starvation and so on. And that was one of the reasons why you wanted to be careful in your relationship with the animal world, to show respect, because people that are out of luck, they would, I knew of men who would even give up trapping because they said they had no luck the year before. They'd done something wrong, and so they weren't even trying to trap because they were out of luck at that period in their life. So it had a strong impact, and that was even more reason to pay attention to what they referred to as Hwetsani, the do's and don'ts of how you should relate to the animal world. Or in Koyukon, it's Hwetlani.
And one family uses Athabasca nicknames among each other.
Uh-huh.
And do you know anything about that? And
is about there any nicknames?
Special? Yeah, Athabasca nicknames.
Yeah. One that came rolling in was a nickname for someone. But nicknames were fairly common. Personal names were later on, the church names on there were not used generally, but so people didn't even use their wife's name. You know, they would refer to it by kinship terms, my wife or something. Or if you were talking about it, you'd say about Mrs. Pete to identify Pete's wife and so on, rather than use her personal name. And the same was true of animals. There were often for animals, there were nicknames for the animals because you weren't supposed to use their real name. And it would be like if I come into the room and I said, Shiaki, immediately you would look at me. So when you use a personal name like that about one of the animals, like even moose or bear or something, all the bears are listening and paying attention to you then. And you see, you had to be very careful about what you were going to say if you really weren't talking about them in general. So there might be the, the grizzly would be that mountain animal, or even raven was referred to as Dautrant, which is really the shitter, which is kind of derogatory. I don't know if he had another name, personal name on there, but they referred to him with circumlocutions on a number of the animals, especially the more powerful ones, rather than use the name of them. And that was true in the village with kinship relationships too. If you refer to someone by their kinship terms of so-and-so's son, daughter, or whatever, rather than their personal name. And that's why I guess the nicknames would come into use, which you could use either with them or in referring to them. And they would change through their life depending on when they were younger, they might have some of them, but then extinguish themselves, they might get another name later in life. And I think there was some recycling of names too, where you might give someone the name of somebody who was recently deceased if they were born close to the same time. And then you would actually enter into relationships like that person, like a young child might be viewed as a grandmother or something like that, where you would have a special relationship with them in memory of the one who had passed on, that because they had their name now. So there was a recycling of names that way.
Is there any person that uses an animal or bird's name as a nicknames?
No, I... My elder son was given the name. He was called Puchi, Rabbit Head, because he was blonde, and the rabbits turn white in the spring and so on there. So they referred him to him as Rabbit Head. So it wasn't giving a specific animal name to him, but it was naming one of his traits for his lighter hair, because everybody else is black haired and so on. So he had him that way. Boy, I don't remember my other son or daughter, whether they had nicknames or not. I think probably there were some of the names. But when the church came in, they adopted Christian names. Even, I thought Sisui was, or not Sis, yeah, even Sisui. There was a Russian here that was saying that was a diminutive of something. They recognized that as coming from a Russian diminutive. And Tanischi is Deniska, I think, in Russian or something like that, is a short of... They came in the English, they were called Denis later on, but there was a Tanischi that was identified by Heron when he went through at Toledo, and I wondered for a long time who that was, and finally I figured out that was a Dennis family. And when I was talking to the Russian who was here studying the language in Nikolai there, he recognized that as, again, I thought that was an Athabascan name, but it wasn't. It turned out to be, again, from a Russian source, the diminutive. So those church names at some point were adopted and became the main names. So you've got the Grigoris and the Sisuis and the Petruscas and so on. And it got confusing because they were usually just given one name, and then one son may take that as the last name, but another one wouldn't, and his name might become the last name for another branch of the family. So there was some of that went on in working with the genealogies. So at some point, though, those first names of one generation became the last names of others.
Yeah, speaking of church, do you remember any preach by the priest or the chief on church day? Like, do you know what kind of stuff they talked about?
What the priest talked about, you mean?
I mean the chief or church leader, community leaders.
Yeah, I had a couple sermons taped, and I haven't transcribed those completely and so on, but often it would be about... behavior in general in the village and so on, or what you should do. And some of it may have been related to older stuff too. Not strictly all just what we would think of as church sermons. But there was a strong feeling that when the Orthodox Church came in, life got better. I remember that being expressed by the old Chief Pete to me. He said, because what happened is some of that feuding that was going on, where there would be a family, and once one member was killed, then there was a feeling you had to retaliate that and so on. So there was those reciprocal things. Originally an offender had called it, but then they would come in and kill that one or somebody in that family, not necessarily the ones who had been the bad guy in the first part, but then that meant that family had to come back and do it. And so there was some of that intertribal, and the sicknesses that hit in like the 1850s and so on, smallpox and some of those other things, that was attributed in part to activity of shamans somewhere else. I mean, they knew the sickness killed them, but why did they get it and so on? And it was felt for bad reading. So there was some retaliation for that. And it also led to stealing of women, because again, if you lost your wife and you had three or four children, you couldn't make a living because you needed to go out and hunt, and who's going to take care of your children? And if, you know, several women had died, you might have a relative or a grandmother or somebody that could fill in, take in orphans or something, but not so one way. Then I think they ended up with a lot more raiding going on, after those sicknesses wiped out part of the population. But anyhow, the church stepped in and stopped some of that, and they stopped talking about who did what. So there were stories about people being kidnapped and so on in the past, but they didn't identify who specifically had done it anymore. They were trying to put that stuff aside. So in that way, the church did have an impact in stopping some of those raids and things. And other stories about somebody going on the last raid over on the Yukon, and one person was from Tanana and somebody from this area, and they'd gone clear over the Yukon to kill somebody over there who was blamed for something. And on the way back, one of them was killed by a bull moose up by Lake Minchumina before he never got made at home, in other words. And that supported what the church was saying, that about there's a price to pay for continuing that fighting, and really you should stop it. And when you didn't, something bad happened to one of those persons. That reinforced the idea that they needed to put that aside. But there were still feelings that the shamans could cause sickness and so on. You know, why did that person suffer or that person die and so on? If they had, they'd look around for reasons, and it may have been attributed to a shamanic power being involved in somehow causing that to happen to that individual.
Somebody told me that Miska Diafon used to make a prediction about the future, you know, something, you know, what might happen in the future at church summons and stuff like that.
Yeah, well, I think that's where the one where they were talking that one year about that maybe this is the year when there's not going to be any summer, when the snows hung on and the teachers left in mid-May from with a ski plane off the swamp, you know. And the ice stayed in the lake clear into June and so on. So that's part of it that he may have been talking about in the church about what's going to happen before. And it might be a reason for what? Your behavior may be impacting that or causing that to happen in part and so on. So you need to be careful about how you lived and so on. And how you treated people and animals and so on. Yeah. So I think that's some of the things that they probably talked about. That I don't have specifics on that, but I know that was the one that did came up while we were there that one time. They started talking about that. Well, maybe this is the one that they were talking about. So there was prophecy about things like that that was carried on down through in the church.
Do you remember Nikolai Ipchuk? Do you know?
Nikolai
Ipchuk. It's a priest from Downriver who used to come up in Nikolai.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh. One of the ones. Father Nikolai.
Washira Changsak.
Okay.
Charles Guest.
Yeah. Yeah, I know the priest from downriver used to serve this area periodically, and there was one priest that stayed up here for a while, way back, and he kind of assisted them in getting the church built at Talida and Nikolai.
Oh.
And he was at Talida for a while, I think, too. But most of the priests came up with the trader from, during the Russian era, came up with the trader from Kamalkovsky down by the redoubt above Aniak there, came up to trade annually, and the priest would come along. I know there's the one story that I had, it's been printed, about, and I think I mentioned in the history book there, where everybody at the mouth of the Holetna, and people from here came clear down to the mouth of the Holetna to trade, and also then the priest stayed after the trader went back and ministered to the people there. But he made the comment in there that some of them had forgotten their names. So when they were first baptized, they'd been given a name, but at that point they weren't using them. So he had to sort that through again and reinforce what their name, the church name was. But he did mention them, that the upbeat people being more pious than some of the ones he'd encountered down below, Yupiks and others and so on. So they took it seriously when they adopted Russian Orthodoxy some. And that was reinforced by Pete's comments, who was the chief there for a while and was one of the readers in the church. And then Miskodiaphon replaced him later when he passed. Well, and then the old chief, I think, had that role maybe when he was Devion before he passed away, was the main, because the chiefs were recognized by the church as well. It was the first and second chief under the church that was recognized. And so they had a role in encouraging people to attend service and speaking in the service and so on. I lost my train of thought. What was I going to say? Well, anyhow, the priests mostly came from downriver during those early years, yeah. But they would come up when the people for weddings and funerals and the special events, things like that, they would send money down to pay for the priest to come in and do that.
I'm wondering if they are Eskimos or the Caucasian.
They were mostly Eskimo or part Eskimo from down below that had been trained as priests down there. Yeah, no one from up here had ever gone through that training. But I don't think they were any Caucasians that came in. I think were like Father Alexa and some of those were in more recent years when they've come in. And he's visited Nikolai and so on. And the priest that's been serving them now, I think, is from the Kenai Peninsula. And his roots are down in Nondalton. So he has Athabascan roots from down there, became a priest.
And I heard that the icons are very powerful. And can you tell me about the power of the icons, like stories about the icons' power?
Well, I know they had some of those in most of their houses there, and they put them up and so on. I don't know any specific ones related to the power of that, but just the fact that that's part of their of the things in the church. And I know they made special efforts to get icons for the church, even to the point in the early years of paddling clear down to somewhere down below to get them from a priest and bringing them back up and so on to put in their church. And I don't, same with the bells that were brought up. And I don't know when the burst bells came in, but that was traded. They didn't come out of Anchorage. I think they came through the Orthodox churches down below. Somehow they traded for those. And in more recent years, I guess they went through to Russia to get one sent in. But all of those, if you observe in the service there is often the icon related to Jesus or Mary, the mother of Jesus, and some of the others there. There's reverence showed those when they go around and at the close of services, some of them, or they're displayed at funerals. Icon, but I don't, I never talked to anybody specifically about what power they had, I think they had them in their houses again for protection, the fact that they would display those things. Just like a lot of Christians have that wear the cross or something else as a symbol of who they are, but also, I guess, feeling that it depends on what branch of Christianity they're of, how important they are, the prayer beads or other things.
I'm wondering if you have any idea when the Slavic or Stalin had started.
That goes back a long time. I think that was going on strong when we came in. And it's the old language that's being used there, so it's had to have been introduced early on. It's not the modern Russian that they're singing some of the songs in and so on. In fact, it's interesting that in rural Alaska, some of those have held on longer than they have in places like Anchorage or somewhere else where some of their more contemporary music is hung on. But I don't know when that started. I just know it was going strong when we were there. And they would have the star, and they would, during the Christmas season, they would visit every house in the village. They even came to our house. We weren't regular attenders at the Orthodox Church, but we attended occasionally there, and we were open to that. And so they would stop at our house, too, as being part of the village, and sing there. And then they always ate something there, and then they move on to the next house. And they made a point, even from Nikolai, to travel up in the wintertime to Lida to do part of the Slavy up there at the homes around. When we were there, that was still going on. And I think that still continued in Nikolai. They tried to keep that tradition going. But I don't know how far back it goes. I would guess that it was fairly early on.
Thank you very much for answering my question.
Okay.
Yeah. All I got.
Okay. Very yeah, much. And there's some other things, though, that there's like the Russian calendar was used, those circular calendars with the pegs in them and so on, because that would tell them when holy days were or something else. So they used to move those around. So they adopted an Orthodox calendar to go with their services and had those in the homes, too, sometimes, and were using them to keep track of so that they would know when Christmas was or other special holidays and so on. That's the only thing I was thinking of that was in related to that. And the fact that everybody usually has a icon at some point. And I think they have those icons blessed by the priest before they take them to their house. I think they get them and either get them through the church or something and have them blessed and then have them displayed in their house.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.